Hi, this is Paul, and a big part of what we're trying to do in this little corner is be a learning community where we're using all of these new online tools to learn from each other. And this morning I released the second big conversation with Rod and Eamon and Catherine about the marriage crisis. And just this morning, Scott Adams on his mainstream let go a pretty dark riff on the state of marriage. And Rod pointed that out to me, sent it to us. I also had just happened to have a little conversation this morning with Eamon and Catherine. And one of the things that Catherine pointed out is part of what we're going to struggle with in this is the increasingly divergent visions for marriage that are in the general population and that is held by Christian churches. You can see that division in C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity as a chapter on sex and marriage. And I often talk about universal marriage versus Christian marriage, because while there certainly are deep connections between them, there are different goals for them. And so I was thinking about these things as I watched Scott Adams talk about marriage, and as I reflected on the comments that we made during our talk. Again, the whole two plus hour video is posted on the channel. You can watch the whole thing. But I thought I would take some certain segments out of it and put it alongside Scott Adams' comments to sort of juxtapose them. And it's very interesting how they all sort of get laid out. A big part of the conversation within the big 2 hour Marriage Crisis Part 2 video is about evolutionary psychology and whether or not that's making a big contribution. So the last thing that Scott Adams said about women and their function biologically or robotically, I thought was extremely telling. So I thought, I'll just do a tiny little bit of editing and I'll put these all together, and I hope the sound level is at least reasonably stable throughout, because that doesn't always happen, and I don't get very fancy with my video editing, trust me. So I thought I'd put this together, and for those of you who don't want to sit through the long process of conversation that so often this little corner takes, maybe some of these little snippets would be helpful.
Is anybody concerned that the relationships can't work anymore, like they sort of can't? I feel like we've crossed some kind of a bridge here socially, and it has something to do with social media, something to do with, I don't know, wokeness, something to do with division, maybe. I don't know. But it doesn't, I don't see men and women agreeing that they should even be together. I'm seeing men and women both agree that the other doesn't offer them enough, right? And the general argument that I'm seeing everywhere from both men and women on social media goes like this. In the old days, there was a definite benefit to getting married and having kids. The biggest benefit is that was your retirement. You had to have kids to take care of you when you're old and to run the farm and to give you physical defense if you had sons, etc. So it certainly made sense. And then there was a period, let's say the 50s, where if the man was working and the woman was raising the kids, as long as everybody was okay with that, that was a system that seemed to be successful. But we're in a different world now. And today, if a woman offers, let's say, herself to a man, this is what I'm seeing on social media. The man says, "What are you offering?" And the woman says, "Well, of course, I will be expensive, because I would expect you to take most of the financial burden," because that appears to be the thing that we hear the most. And the guy says, "Okay, so that's what you're going to take from me. You're going to take my money. Now, what are you giving me?" And she'll say, "Well, I'll give you children." And then the guy says, "Okay, so you can guarantee that no matter what happens with us, I get to keep those children?" And she'll say, no. "If something happens to us, I'll probably keep the children." So he goes, "Okay, you're not really giving me children. Like, you can't even offer that. It's not within your power." And then she says, but you don't have to worry about that because I will offer you faithfulness. I will be true to you and only physical with you. And then you don't have to worry about us breaking up and taking the kids. Then the man says, I live in the real world. As soon as you're financially capable of taking care of yourself and your kids, why would you stay with me when you could find somebody better? And then she would say, well, that's a good point. I could find somebody better. Because once I have enough of your money and I have kids, you know who's going to look not so good? Whoever you're living with is going to not look good. Because your coworker is always, you know, clean and well-dressed, and that's the only time you ever see them. But you're at home, you're seeing, you know, the worst of your mate. So women and men are asking the same question. What are women offering to men in 2022? And I actually don't know the answer to the question. I'm not being argumentative. I don't know. What do they offer? If the most they can offer is a 25% chance that you'll live a happy life and get to see your kids the whole time, is that something you want to trade your entire net worth for? Your entire financial future, you're going to trade for a 25% chance of being able to see your kids in 20 years? I mean, it just doesn't sound like anything that anybody would do if they were rational. Now, I think that we're a zombie culture. A zombie culture in that we're doing what we used to do, even though it doesn't make sense anymore. So we're still sort of running through the, oh, I guess I'm dating, and I guess I'm supposed to get myself a wife, and, you know. So I think we're just zombieing our way toward it with no sense that it makes any sense at all, or that it even could. You're saying feminists ruined everything? I don't know about that. Maybe it was the economy that did. Maybe it was consumerism that ruined everything, because then you needed two jobs. You could take this a lot of ways. But am I wrong that women are not offering anything to men that is reliable? They do offer, but nothing reliable or lasting. Would you agree? Now, is it the same the other way? Would you say that men do not offer anything to women? Because I feel like they offer money sometimes and physical protection sometimes. But do men really offer physical protection to women? Think about it. Do men really offer physical protection to women within the house? All right, women? Tell me, who has been your biggest physical threat over the course of your life? Somebody inside your house or somebody outside your house? There's no competition. The biggest physical threat to a woman is a male inside their house. Right? I don't think in 2022 men protect women. I think men are a bigger threat to women than they are a protection. Now, obviously, it depends on the situation. Plenty of cases where men are legitimately protecting women, right? Don't have a heart attack over this, right? Plenty of cases where the man is absolutely protecting the woman. But what I'm saying is the woman really seeing that benefit? If you're a 20-year-old woman and the only time you've ever been abused is by your own boyfriend, maybe once or twice, are you saying to yourself, I really need a man to protect me? Or are you saying, I'd better live alone because the most dangerous thing I could do is live with a man? I don't know. But so I think the entire, what do we call it in business? The value proposition. I think the value proposition for both the men and the women is that they're not offering what they used to. Not offering what they used to.
Since I'm the only one on this call who's been divorced. Which I also think you almost can't talk about marriage without talking about divorce.
Yeah.
I left my first marriage after 10 years. So after we had our first conversation, of course, that gets you thinking. And I can riff with the best of them, but maybe I'll actually try to read what I wrote as a result of it. Because Eamon said something in the first conversation. I actually went back and found it and listened to that part again. It just kind of grabbed me, and he was really just kind of saying it in passing too. But I thought it just had some hooks in it that I thought were really interesting. So I'm going to read this, or try to read it anyway. See if at least that way I'll get it right. So what I wrote was, something clicked for me during our first conversation when Eamon briefly described a capitalist approach to marriage as something like, I make myself a good product that you buy, you make yourself a good product that I buy. We can have an exchange here where we both get what we want. And the title of this little rant is Love is Unconditional, Relationships Are Not. That was my subject heading. You know, maybe it would be better to say love, you know, might be unconditional, but relationships are definitely not. Anyway, so I've been circling the subject for a while and alluded to it in some of my comments, but I'm starting to get more clarity and really do think it's foundational to the subject of marriage and its relevance or lack thereof for a modern world. And if my instincts are correct, marriage is in very, very big trouble. An expression I heard years ago and I never forgot was, love is unconditional, relationships are not. Now, frankly, it's not exactly true that love is unconditional, although maybe some people wish it were. But the distinction between love and relationships was a crucial step in my thinking. You can love someone and definitely not want to be married to them. In other words, relationships are conditional. If no-fault divorce has any salutary effect, it may be to keep us all a little bit more honest in how we relate to our spouses. Once you've introduced the idea that people might have conditions, and not just for romantic partners, but any kind of relationship, the entire liberal project begins to teeter. Of course, there have always been conditions placed on any member of society, but when those were relatively universal and culturally enforced, your mileage wouldn't vary too much. If a woman went looking for a husband, both she and he, and pretty much everyone else, knew approximately what husband meant, and vice versa. In other words, these words described roles, and those roles were crucial to a stable society. How many people do you know today who are raising their children to become good wives or good husbands? And this issue extends far beyond dating and marriage. One of the founding principles of most Western democracies is the freedom of association. Yet as soon as you give people the freedom to associate, you also give them the freedom to not associate. As soon as people have the declared right to decide who they hang out with, guess what? Inequality skyrockets, inherent biases go from being covert to overt, and inevitably the discourse shifts from equality to equity. Legislative efforts have emerged over time to address cases where not associating equates to prohibited discrimination. But this is always a blunt instrument and woefully inadequate to address the much deeper issue. The fact remains that you can't make someone care about you. In love, dating, marriage, friendships, even work. In other words, in life, you're really going to need people to care about you. And those people are going to have conditions. And those conditions often turn out to be quite uncomfortable. I want my wife to love me and accept me as I am. Who doesn't, right? How about if I gain 100 pounds or gamble away our savings or take up a drug habit? It turns out she has all kinds of conditions that were taking shape long before she met me. One time she shared with me a list she had been encouraged to create by a friend. The idea was to manifest the man she was looking for. But writing down a list of his traits. Good news, seems to have worked because it was a pretty extensive list. And I checked every box except for a love of baseball. She now wonders why she wrote that one. I enjoy a game here and there, but it really does drag on, doesn't it? Anyway, she put a lot of thought into compiling a very long list of things she was looking for in a man. You might call those conditions. What she hadn't done pretty much at all was think about what that man might want from her or what kind of relationship she was hoping to create with him. When the first online dating sites emerged, conditions became much more overt. There it was, right at the start. You create a profile, you give your basic stats, height, body type, income range, etc. Then you describe what you're looking for. The first person who filled out one of those forms on Match.com, if they were paying attention, could have predicted what would happen next. The Manosphere calls it the sexual marketplace. Anyone hoping that they'd be loved just for who they are was in for a rude awakening. In the last 20 years or so, we all learned, as if we didn't know, that what men look for in a woman is starkly different than what women look for in a man. And for some people in particular, this fell somewhere between infuriating and deeply painful. Some men tend to be attracted to looks. The younger, within reason, and prettier, the better. Women tend to be attracted to height, status, wealth, power. Both sides of this are deeply vexing and often out of reach. You can't get younger, for example, or taller. And even if you think you'd be perfectly happy with your average partner in an average life, there's social media reminding you just how beautiful a woman can be and just how big a house that kind of money can buy. Once we acknowledge that people have conditions, we inevitably begin to argue about which conditions are fair and which are not, which inevitably points to some kind of universal system of values that the liberal project is allergic to. If you ever find yourself at a multi-generational event, let's say a wedding, and you end up seated at a table with an elderly couple that's been married for 60 years, ask them their secret. Chances are the answers will seem banal to you. He'll say something like he saw her across the room at the Saturday night dance. He liked her pretty blue eyes and the way she smiled. Or she'll say something like compromise or communication. It's very likely that you'll go away from that conversation no wiser about how to end up like them when you're in your 80s. How many of the greatest generation went off to fight in World War II with a locket in their pocket of the pretty girl back home? How many lifelong marriages were formed out of something as flimsy as he liked the way she laughed at his jokes? Today, we all want more than just someone who will laugh at our jokes. This raises more questions than it answers, but perhaps we return to Amon's comment. Except the product I'm offering might instead be the qualities of my character, my values, my virtue, how I relate to my fellow human beings, not the least of which being my spouse and immediate family. So perhaps the redemptive thread we can offer is if you want to find a good wife, make yourself a good husband, and vice versa. And a very generative conversation could be, in light of the drastic realignment of gender roles and norms, with two-income families becoming the broad norm, and allowing that male and female attraction, while somewhat malleable, won't change much. What today makes for a good spouse, and how would a motivated person go about becoming one? But they also have a point, right?
Yes.
So the extremes of the manosphere are kind of easy to, you know, it's just kind of a cesspool of misogyny and anger and bitterness and pain. But the contract, the implied contract, many of the things that men might be, let's put it this way. As I said earlier, you know, she had a pretty clear idea of what she was looking for. She had basically no idea what I was looking for. And why would she? Like, who cares what a guy wants, right? It turns out that if you're, you know, my comments in the last, you know, conversation about being a young woman with, you know, with the world of options laid out for you. Well, the same is true if you're a little bit of an older guy where, yeah. Right? And maybe you've figured some things out. Well, why exactly would you get married, right? Well, I can think of a bunch of things that would be really, really nice, but I'm afraid to say them out loud in public, almost all of them. And they're not the things you might be thinking. It's nothing, you know, it's not sex. It's, you know, I mean, sure, yeah. but it's things like just the quality of the experience. If I use the word receptive, for example, like that's a word that I think really captures something about the way a man responds to a woman. If she's receptive, you know, so if you're buying what I'm selling, right? Like, that's a great feeling for a guy. Like, this is working. She's laughing at my jokes. It's going well, right? But I could go on. There's other things in terms of the quality of that experience that are extremely controversial now. Just the sort of what a man might describe as a good experience with a woman relationally. If you say it out loud, you're already feeding into the patriarchy, right? You're already contributing to the oppressive system, right? And so the point that maybe the less extreme voices of, let's, you know, for a while there, it was the MGTOW thing, right? Men going their own way. That was more, it seemed, guys who maybe actually had the option, but decided not to, right? It wasn't necessarily that they were the incels or whatever, right? So there is a, they do have a point, which is this is like really not a good deal for men. And it's beyond divorce court. It's also just like, why would you, right?
Yes.
And I think, to bounce off your point about women and what men are looking for in women, I think part of the challenge is that femininity is so shameful in our culture, right? Women are shamed for being feminine. You can't even mention the feminine qualities you would like because they're so shameful, we're not even allowed to talk about them. You, and I don't know what your list is, but I would assume things like submissive, soft, gentle.
Cooperative. Can we say cooperative?
Cooperative, sure. But even talking in that category, like you said, that is potentially like wildfire culturally, but those are traditionally the postures, the relational stance that were associated and expected from women and most women held. And I think, you know, it's a quick breeze through, you know, old English literature to see that was what was valued, not just by men in women, but by other women in women. That was not seen as something shameful. It was something that women could be honored for, their gentle spirit, their receptivity, whatever, you know. And I'm sure there's different flavors. Of course, people always like different things. But I think you're right that even saying, oh, I would like that in a wife, it's very taboo. And I find it, frankly, annoying as a woman that being feminine and embracing things like cooperation or submission or however you want to nuance it is seen as something you should be ashamed of, as if it's a relinquishing of your agency or a relinquishing of personal dignity instead of a posture one can choose to take and enjoy. Now, but culturally that is so off the table that it really hamstrings conversations like this.
Another thing that comes up in the manosphere a lot is and we kind of alluded to this a little bit the last time, is like, oh, you like me now, do you? Right? Like sort of watching. I have a good friend who has three young adult sons. They're in their early 20s. Mm-hmm. And the first thing they do when they meet a girl is they go check out her socials. And if there's a lot of, you know, bikini pics and things like that, you know, you might say they form some conclusions, right? Mm-hmm. So they're watching all this play out and it's influencing their opinion of the entire enterprise and their opinion of women and all of that, right? So I think it's worth inserting here this idea of settling. It's time to settle down. How would you like to be the one where you knew that she'd settled on you, right? That, you know, you run the gauntlet, and then there's some point where magically, you know, the music stops and everybody finds a seat, and well, you'll do. So I heard somebody say this and I just loved it, that men are romantics masquerading as pragmatists and women are pragmatists masquerading as romantics.
That's good.
All the great love literature, you know, all the great love poems, all the songs. I mean, it's all men, right? It's men pouring their hearts out, these poor schmucks, right? So the reality is men are deeply romantic, and when they decide on a woman, kind of my little, you know, he liked her pretty blue eyes, right? He could write an entire lifetime of a narrative around her just based on that first impression, that first thought he had about her when he met her. And as long as she didn't do anything to disavow him of that, they could do a lifetime together. He'd be as devoted to her 60 years later as he was the day that he laid eyes on her, right? So, and Paul, we talked about this on our first conversation. I think we did anyway.
Yeah, we did.
Well, I started to sort of think about marriage as like a historic overlay. Mm-hmm. We live in a neighborhood here where there's been a ton of gentrification, a lot of new building, a lot of houses, you know, they're knocking down the old houses, putting up big ones. And you know, people started to get upset about this. So they passed this historical overlay, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't just build whatever you want, right? They're trying to at least slow down the process, right? So there's a more approval process. And relevant as we are working on a remodel. So we're sort of going through like what you can and cannot do. And it made me think of like marriage is kind of like that too, right? It's like you can almost imagine the how it would emerge from the history of human civilization as you have these raging hormones. You have, you know, all the young men of the village are all killing each other over the same girl. And it's like, no, we can't have this, right? You can almost see like how norms would start to come into place to just kind of regulate the whole thing, because it's just a free-for-all and there's just too much instability because of the nature of being young and, you know, you're coursing with hormones and attraction and all that, right? And so what we've done, you know, somewhat successfully, is convince young people to sort of wait all that out, you know, get through till you're in your late 20s, at least early 30s. So basically when you're not really that motivated.
And how about having kids? Let me be brutally honest. In the old days, like what I imagine the old days in the 60s, I think having a kid was sort of a good deal, because you could interact with your kids and sometimes you could do some family stuff that everybody liked. Do you know what it's like having a kid today? Well, if you don't have a kid, allow me to give you my impression in one act of all of your quality interaction with your kid after the age of 10. Uh-huh. Yep. Uh-huh. Right. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. Pretty satisfying, wasn't it? Now, that's the sort of thing you want to organize your entire life around. Because if you do everything right, you can get that. Yeah. You can have the satisfying experience of having your kid not give a fucking shit about whether you live or die. They only care what's on social media. And you get to make one of those. And then get to sit there and feel like what you did wrong. Because every moment you sit with that kid, you'll fucking hate your life. Because you're like, I love the kid, but I fucking hate this. I hate this moment. I hate dinner. I hate sitting in the car. I hate walking with him. I hate having a conversation. Shut off their phones. Try shutting off a phone. Has anybody tried punishing a kid by turning off their phone? How'd that work out? I mean, it happens all the time. Have you ever seen anybody change their behavior because you turned off their phone for a week? I haven't. I've never seen any kid change their behavior because they lose their phone. Because they just find a laptop or an iPad usually. Cernovich's kids, let's say, don't have screen time. Yeah, so that's also true of people in the tech business. The people who are least likely to allow their kids to use technology are the people who make it. You know that, right? The people who are least likely to get hernia surgery are who? What class of people are the least likely to get hernia surgery? Doctors who perform hernia surgeries, because they know too much. Right? The people who make your technology are the ones who don't let their kids see it.
I thought it was great, your little line, Rod, with the men are romantics posing as pragmatists and women are the reverse. And I think you revealed the fact that I am pragmatist. I'm also romantic, but when you were like, well, who wants to have somebody just settle for you? I was like, that sounds great. What's wrong with having someone settle for you? Why is that a problem?
It depends what I think about the person who's settling, right? Where you're like, I'm just happy to be here.
No, we have these heroic narratives where we have the key that unlocks her heart. Only we have that key, right? Like a lot of men think this way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But then I thought, yeah, I wouldn't like someone to settle for me if what that meant was we both were locking arms for the modern vision of marriage, to kind of pull the conversation back to the beginning again. Because if you're just settling for me and you get tired of what I have to offer and you weren't really sold on me in the first place, then that's probably not going to last very long. But if you are willing to settle for me and stop searching around for the ideal that probably only exists in your head or in a magazine somewhere, and you would settle into my vision of marriage, which means we're committed, we're doing this thing, and we're going to make it about more than just us, then I love it. Because I'm like, oh yeah, well, you're going to get attached to me. You're going to enjoy me. I'm going to make sure you have a great time. We're going to build a life together, and then you're not going to want to go anywhere. So I don't mind if you settle, because that's just the beginning. That's not the pinnacle I was trying to reach. We're just getting building at this point. So
I was just going to say, it was just the flimsiest of hunches that made me want to include you in this conversation, because we had talked that one time. I am so glad.
Oh, I knew she needed to be here.
Yeah, I mean, you really do such a great job of articulating that thing that's hard for us to talk about. But anyway, sorry.
Well, thanks, Rod.
We didn't settle for you, Catherine.
Oh, good. Well, and Catherine and I have talked about, when we initially got together, the different perspectives we came from, because I believe it was one of her relatives that said to her, you know, Catherine, you could have almost anybody you want. So like, why are you with him? Are you sure you want to do this?
And somehow you found out about this.
Yeah, she told me.
Remember those lists we got?
But I'd be like, why are you telling me this?
Oh no, brace myself. But I think you said something to the effect of like, well, you saw what I could become.
Well, yeah, I said, well, it was my grandfather who's now passed, and he married us. But what I told him was, well, I picked him because I could have who I wanted, and I wanted him. And then I think I felt so flustered, I just left. But what I was thinking was, it's true, he wasn't, I don't know, you were like 20 when we were dating, right?
Yeah.
So it's like you hadn't completed a degree, you hadn't like accomplished anything.
Let's remind the audience that he was looking for a woman with a few knocks on her too.
That's right. Taking my... That's father's right. advice.
So I was already starting with an edge.
Yes.
So it's like, yeah, I could, as a young woman, have found a guy who already had established himself and was well on his career and had a house, and I was at the point in the sexual marketplace where I could have gone shopping, but building from the beginning, what you're looking for, and this goes to what you said at the end of your letter, Rod, you're asking what will make a good husband? Like, what are the character traits? What are the qualities of somebody that will make a good husband? And that's different than, I'm going to find somebody with an established setup I can just slip into. Now, that might be part of the package in somebody's mind, but they're not exactly the same thing.
Well, you're saying something important here, which is there's a difference when someone has explored all their options and they arrive at you as the best of those options. While we're all hyper-connected, we're all on social media, we're all aware that, well, maybe your options have changed a year ago, right? So like the idea that someone has said, having reviewed all of my options, I've picked you, versus long before I'm a known commodity, I'm making a bet on you, right? There's just a complete difference between waiting until you kind of know how the story goes before you pick the winner. And so that idea of, you know, loyalty, you know, picking the dark horse, you know, like, you know, right. And going back to my sort of historical overlay idea, I think that that's one of the functions that marriage used to serve, which is, yeah, I know he's kind of scrawny and pimply and, you know, doesn't much going for him yet. So you're going to have to look for all kinds of signs that, like, he's going to amount to something someday, right? So it's going to be other things, you know, his character, his family, he's a hard worker or something. You know, you're going to have to sort of figure it out, because if you wait until he's the successful doctor with a large practice and he's 40, 45 years old, and then you decide you want him, well, guess what? Like, you know, so do a lot of other people, right? So you're letting him know, I'm going to make a bet on you before I know how the story ends. And the same thing goes for women, right? If she just takes advantage of all of her options, well, that to the person she ends up with, that says something to him about her, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even if you're the winner in that exchange, it's sort of like after all the other merchandise has been sampled. So it's a different thing.
Mm-hmm. Back to November 9th, when you said women were toxic to men. Women are toxic to men. Yeah, but that's a biological explanation. The biological explanation is that the biological purpose of a woman is to transfer resources from a man to a child. So, there you go. I mean, from a machine perspective, that's what the machine is doing. The machine has created these creatures where the shift of resources works very well for keeping the next generation alive.
Okay, if not marriage, then what? That's sort of my question with all of this. Mm-hmm. Because it's so funny, because I often, like, I've had, you know, I've been married to one woman for almost 35 years now. I've only had sex with one woman my entire lifetime. You know, to me, evolutionary psychology would say, Vanderclay's a loser. I mean, well, maybe I've had five children, so I've done a little seed spreading, but but I regularly meet guys who have had, you know, have had sex that evolutionary psychology would say, oh, he's a top dude. He's had, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60, 100 plus sexual partners their life. And, you know, they'll, at some point, if we develop enough of a relationship, they'll look at me and say, I wish I had what you have. And they're not speaking Christian terms. They're just, you know, and, you know, my marriage isn't perfect and everything isn't always to my liking, et cetera, but they look from the outside and say, you know what, you have, on Thanksgiving, you know, you were surrounded by people who loved you, mm-hmm. and you loved them. And there's a sense in that little group that, yeah, you know, we might have our little spats, but, you know, when the chips are down, we've all got each other's back and we're here for each other and we love each other. And, you know, no matter what happens, even divorce or whatever, there'll be a foundation of love here that probably nothing will sever in, mm-hmm. in your lifetime. You've built that. And in a lot of ways, I would have to say, when I was in my 20s, I was too dumb to think of anything like this. But, you know, the mark of a healthy culture is it affords wisdom to people who haven't had enough time in their life to generate it themselves. And, you know, I got to be really careful with that, because, you know, Rod, you know, your story, you did the right thing. You got married young, and, you know, and I'm not going to point fingers, because I don't know the details and I don't even want to know. But
well, I wanted to speak up here because I would be one of those people who admire you, Paul, and it's unknown whether I will be able to have children. We're hopeful. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you have to at least consider the possibility that the main contribution that you can make is a cautionary tale. And part of my interest in this topic and in this conversation is that I want to show up as someone who can speak to that. I may not be able to have my own children. And, you know, as I said, we're hopeful. I would even accept your prayers. Mm-hmm. But the, you know, you're alluding to this. I'll make it easy for you, Paul. Because, yeah, I made the choices that were available to me. You know, you might say I optimized. And I, you know, I say that sarcastically. So I completely understand why someone would envy you that, because I would be one of those people. I'm not saying I envy what it took to get that.
Yeah.
But I envy the outcome.
Yeah. Like Dale Cooper's father. I don't envy anything that happened to him, but I envy the kind of, I can envy the kind of man he became by the difficult circumstances that were pressed upon him and the way that he engaged them. Because, yeah. And this is, I mean, a lot of people are quick to dismiss the hero's journey, and it certainly has its limitations and shortcomings, but there is really something deep to it. It's just that there are many different kinds of heroes, and a lot depends on what graph you're charting heroism.
Yeah, so.